on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Another aspect is the way in which pagan ideas are now taking hold in philosophy and psychology. When you think of, for example, the work of James Hillman, now he's extremely interesting because he was in effect a kind of pagan. And there's one book of his that's very interesting called Re-envisioning Psychology, where he talks about how paganism is a much better way, or a much better lens through which to see the human mind than monotheism is, because the human mind is actually many people under one roof. And so the pagan, the polytheistic perspective is a much better way of approaching the human mind. And his view of the gods is very interesting. There's one lecture of his, it's actually posted on the internet, where he quotes, in fact, something that Joseph Campbell wrote, which was that the gods are not dead. They are alive and well, and standing on the corner of Broadway and 42nd Street, waiting for the lights to change. So, well, I've passed that corner many times when I was living in New York, but I wasn't looking out for gods at the time. But if I had been, I might have seen a few.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I welcome back author Christopher McIntosh to discuss his latest book, The Call of the Old Gods, which is a spiritual memoir detailing his journey and experiences in paganism. McIntosh explains the different aspects of paganism and how it satisfies various human needs that Christianity does not fully address. He also touches on his personal influences, his connection to the Icelandic pagan community, cultural memory, and the importance of sacred spaces and traditions. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Christopher McIntosh is a British-born writer and historian specializing in the esoteric traditions of the West. He has a doctorate in history from Oxford University, a degree in German from London University, and a diploma in Russian from the United Nations Language School. He is the author of many books, including Beyond the North Wind, Occult Russia, and Occult Germany. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, The Call of the Old Gods. Christopher, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, I'm very happy to speak with you again. This is your third time on the podcast, yes. So thank you very much for that. And I really enjoyed your latest book, The Call of the Old Gods. As I mentioned in an email to you, I mean, the book is, I think it's fair to refer to it as a memoir, or I think maybe even more appropriately, a spiritual memoir. Yes. And it was very nice to get some information and insight into you as a person and the life you've lived. So I really appreciate that, because now you feel more like, I know you a little bit better than just this author of these two books that we talked about before. So I really appreciate all of that. You've lived a very interesting life, and there seems to be a lot of connections. And eventually there was, as I was reading your book, a name popped up and I'm like, I know them. And I thought, this is a small, small world. So let's talk about sort of your journey, because at the heart of this is you, I guess, becoming pagan. Sometimes you also say that you might refer to yourself as a heathen, but typically throughout the book you used pagan. And you're involved with, and I should have asked you about the pronunciation of this, I'm never sure. Is it Asatru?
Asatru, yes.
Asatru, okay. So your book kind of explains all this journey, and we want to encourage people to read it, and it's an interesting journey. But I'm wondering if maybe we can talk about the paganism sort of in general and what you understand that to be, because I always like to ask about definitions, but also how, and again, in general, you know, what do you understand that to be, and how did that nourish you in ways that other traditions may not have?
Well, I would say that paganism satisfies the human being on various different levels. And initially, I had conceived of there being four levels, namely the soul, the mind, the heart, and the belly. And by the belly, I mean the visceral Dionysian part of ourselves, the visceral passionate part of ourselves. Now, Christianity has a lot for the soul. It has a lot for the heart. It has not so much for the brain, the mind, and nothing for the belly, apart from those ecstatic sects that go in for snake handling and so on. They can be said to have a lot for the belly, but on the whole, Christianity doesn't have much for the belly. So I would say that paganism satisfies all of those levels. But then I realized that there are two more levels that are also important, namely the feet, or rather not the feet themselves, but the ground on which they stand. In other words, the place, the territory where you feel at home, either because you were born and brought up there, or because it's the place where you've decided to put down roots. So that is another important level. And by the territory, the land, I mean everything that goes with it, the nature, the wildlife, the culture, the folk traditions, the customs, the music, everything that goes with it. So one wants to celebrate those things. So that's another important level. And another one is the hands. By that I mean what Rudolf Steiner meant when he said that spirituality should not just float up above in some ethereal realm, but it should be brought down through the hands into the physical world. And he himself was a good example of that. When you think of all the things that he did, the biodynamic agriculture, the Waldorf schools, the system of medicines that he developed, and the eurythmy dance method and all of that. So he really practiced what he preached. So that's another important level. And so paganism to me satisfies all of these levels. So it's taken me a long time to come to that realization. So it's been a very circuitous and roundabout path that's brought me there.
Yeah. And we'll look at some of the highlights on that path. But I'm glad you brought all of that up, because I did have in my notes here, you have a chapter, I think it's called The Fivefold Path, where you talk about the soul, mind, heart, belly, and feet, but you didn't talk about the hands in this chapter, I don't think. But I really appreciated personally the feet aspect of it. And the land, and your definition of land kind of reminded me a little bit of the ecologist Aldo Leopold and the land ethic is what he's best known for. And he describes the land as a kind of circuit of energy. It's the soil and the entire the ecosystems and everything that lives there. But I think it's important that you bring in culture to all of this as well. And there's something, because you also have experience, and forgive me if we jump around a little bit, but you've got experience that you worked for the UN for a long time. And you wrote that your experiences at the UN, especially working with doing development, kind of led you to, in many ways, where you are. And there seems to be this tension between sort of the Enlightenment project. And I think we can, you know, make it, you know, kind of explain it in terms of maybe even the general to the universal to the particular. And that we've been on this path that is kind of erasing, in many ways, the particular. So I was curious if you could maybe speak about that experience and how it led you to paganism and this embrace of more individual land-based spirituality.
Yes. Well, to me, cultural memory is very important. And cultural memory is really almost by definition local. So there is really no authentic global cultural memory. It's always at a local level. So this really leads to a pagan perspective. Now, it also has to do with the what I call the two types of paradigm. On the one hand, the linear paradigm, which says that all human history goes in a straight line towards the promised land or the second coming or the last judgment or whatever, but always moving forward, forward, forward in a straight line. Whereas in the pagan religions, in polytheism, everything goes in a great circle, including human history. Because for a time, we enjoy a golden age of peace and prosperity. And then comes conflict and war and destruction, and everything goes up in smoke. But then after a time, the world is reborn out of the ashes. And there comes a new golden age, and the cycle continues. So this cyclical thinking, which is characteristic of paganism, is another reason why I'm a pagan. So this linear paradigm is something that it started in the religious realm, but it's become transferred to the secular realm. So, for example, you see it in the world of the arts, where artists are not supposed to look back and be inspired by the art of the past, by the artistic traditions of the past. They have to constantly be creating things that are challenging and forward-looking and thought-provoking and always doing something new, never looking back. It's the same in architecture, which is why so many of our cities today are hideous places. So this is another important aspect. Yeah, what else can I say about that? It's as though we are standing. It's as though we're on a conveyor belt. The conveyor belt is moving forward the whole time, and we evaluate things from the point of view of the present and the future. The past is something that's no longer relevant. So if you take that attitude, if you encourage people to take that attitude, you're going to erode cultural memory. And all you're going to end up with is the global monoculture, which, as I said, isn't a culture, isn't an authentic culture at all. It can't be because it has no roots.
Yeah, I liked the idea of that you mentioned about monotheism being the straight line, and there's often, I think, unrecognized religious undertones. So like you said, you know, with that straight line, it's all heading towards apocalypse, essentially. And, you know, there's also within capitalism and Max Weber, who you talk about in terms of this idea of the disenchantment of the world, he also talks about how the capitalist idea is really rooted in this Puritan ethic. There's these, you know, this monotheistic idea that is still sort of rampant in the world. And it seems like with development, what we're doing is often placing that, you know, unrecognized monotheism upon all these cultures, and it just creates this homogenization. And we lose this sense of place often, and that is definitely connected to the land. You know, you talked about London, where, you know, I'm probably going to be heading. And in the 60s through the 80s, I think, and probably before, you said that it was kind of the center of esoteric knowledge and research and whatnot. But now, not so much. London's changed.
I'm afraid it has, and it hasn't changed for the better. When I lived in London back in the 1960s and 70s and early 80s, it had a wonderful sort of romantic, dreamy quality, and it was partly a kind of Dickensian atmosphere. Well, there were huge parts of London that were rather sleepy and a little bit melancholy, but very congenial somehow, and you felt it was a place where interesting surprises would happen. You know, you'd be walking down a little back street somewhere, and you'd come across a dusty old bookshop where you'd find some bargain, some treasure for practically nothing. And it's lost that sort of atmosphere, and it's become it. Last time I was there, I had the impression it was as though somebody had decided to make London look more like New York by plonking down high-rise buildings everywhere, you know, regardless of the surroundings. So, but having said that, it's still, I think I would say to some extent, a center for esotericism. There are still wonderful bookshops, like Watkins Bookshop, that used to be a favorite haunt of mine, and the Atlantis Bookshop, and Treadwell's Bookshop. So, and there are wonderful libraries as well, like the British Library, the Warburg Institute, the Library of the Theosophical Society. So that dimension is still there.
Okay, yeah. I visited Watkins and Atlantis while I was visiting.
Oh, did you?
The past few times. In fact, the first time I ever visited London, I think I stumbled across Watkins books. And had a few books here from them. And I've actually ordered from them, too, while I was in the States and had books delivered. Because you couldn't find, you know, what they had anywhere else. And the last time I was there in April, I did visit the Warburg Institute because they had tarot exhibit. But I see your point. I also can see that the first time I ever visited London was in the, I think, 1994. And I can tell a difference from then where it is now. And it does feel kind of like New York.
Yes. It had a kind of magic, really, which it no longer has, except in little pockets.
Yeah. Well, and my understanding is part of this is because of, I guess, the secularization of Europe in many ways, that it's becoming way more secular, and people seem to have a little bit less interest in the spiritual. And I can't help but wonder, you know, because it seems like London is losing its soul a little bit. And as that happens, you know, maybe we put the cart before the horse by saying, well, people are losing their interest, and therefore, of course, you're going to find less of this in the city. But maybe it's that the city is starting to lose it, and that's why people begin losing the interest.
Although you say there's a decline of interest in the spiritual, but that doesn't apply so much to the pagan movement, which is growing stronger all the time.
Well, that's good to know. Here in the States, I don't know that paganism is growing, but it's the spiritual but not religious is how people identify themselves. And I think that we don't have a name for it yet, and it is very pagan, but there is this sense of nature, finding the divine or the transcendent in nature, and there's a history to that. But, you know, you noted, and this is something that I'm always worried about here, is that, let's see if I can find your quote. I'm looking for a specific quote here. And this goes into the ideas of development and progress, that sacred places have become diminished, and so many sacred places are connected to the land.
That's right.
So what would be your vision of an alternative to this monotheistic, homogenous, progressive culture? How can we retain what was really good from the Enlightenment, but yet also preserve individual cultures?
That's a very big question.
Yes, I'm putting you on the spot. You must have an answer.
I think one could look at a country like Iceland as a model. Iceland is a country that I've had a lot to do with over the years, because the head of the pagan community, the Asatru community in Iceland, is an old friend of mine, Hilmar Örn Hilmarsson. He's been in the Asatru movement since he was a teenager. And he's seen it grow enormously over the years. So it's now has a membership of, I think, about 10,000, which in a country like Iceland, which only has about 400,000 people, that's a very large number. And that's only people who are officially members of it. There's many other people would consider themselves pagans, and it's woven into the tradition and the culture. So you have, for example, the belief in the elves, which is very deeply rooted. So to the extent that there are certain areas that are considered to be inhabited by the elves, and you're not allowed to encroach on these areas. So, you know, there have been cases where there was a plan to build a road, but it turned out the road went through elf territory, so the road had to be diverted. So I would consider Iceland as an encouraging example of a place where paganism and pagan traditions are very deeply rooted.
One of the things that came to mind while you were speaking was, you know, we have lost our sacred spaces and our sacred places, especially those that are connected to nature. And it makes me wonder if, you know, it's that separation from the natural world that feeds into this disenchantment. And I'm wondering if, you know, people actually spend more time out in the forests or, you know, the mountains, what have you, that they will start recognizing the spirit of the land, and maybe that there are other spirits as well that have been part of our traditions for a long time. But now everyone's like, oh, that's just nonsense. But it's like, I wonder, you know, if you spent so much, if you spent a good amount of quality time connecting to the land where you are and, you know, the trees and everything, that you might not start experiencing some of these old spirits, and maybe they're
and the spirits like to be celebrated. So if they sense that you are celebrating them in a spirit of reverence, then they will respond. And also we have the capacity to create sacred spaces, which I'm trying to do to some extent here where we live, by creating a sacred and symbolic garden, what I call a garden of the mysteries. That's to say the mysteries, the classical mysteries of ancient Greece and Rome, and the Celtic and Nordic mysteries of the North, and the Hermetic mysteries. So I'm trying to create a space in which those mysteries are celebrated. And I have the sense that there's an energy that is, there's an energy there, which would just perhaps come as a result of what I've done.
Yeah. No, I like that, and I like how you, and I still have yet to read your book on the Garden of the Gods.
Oh, yes.
Which I do want to do. But there is something, you know, I mean, gardening itself connects us to the earth.
Yes.
There's something about, you know, getting your hands dirty and having that soil and recognizing the cycle of life and death that creates the soil, and that it's a living thing. And just having our hands in it seems to sort of charge the soul in many ways.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if, just for anyone in the audience who's listening or watching, if you could maybe say a little bit more about Asatru and what it is. And I know that there's also, and you address this in the book, sometimes there's a incorrect view. People have some negative ideas about Asatru. So I was wondering if you could speak to what Asatru is, and maybe address these sort of false notions.
Well, to start off with the false notions, if you were a follower of any religion, you wouldn't give up that religion because it's abused by certain people. So that's what I always say in answer to that point. So what is Asatru? Well, it's the continuation of the old Nordic religion, which is embodied in the, for example, in the Edda, the collection of Old Norse poems about the gods. And it's also embodied in the sagas, the great Icelandic sagas. So these are really the essential sources. That there are, paganism has very, very few written sources. And this is one of the problems of trying to revive paganism today, is that it's short on written sources, but we do have the Edda and the sagas, and they contain a whole system of morality, really. If you follow the precepts in the Edda and the sagas, They basically teach you how to live a good and full life. So that's one aspect of it. We also have the sacred sites, obviously. We have certain customs and traditions that have been handed down to us from the Nordic tradition. We have place names. In Britain, there are any number of place names named after Woden, for example. So, and it's also in our language, when you think of the names of the days of the week. So you have Tuesday named after the god Tyr, Wednesday after Woden or Odin, Thursday after Thor or Donar, as they say here, and Friday after Freya, the Nordic goddess of love and passion. So in a way, it's all there. It's just a question of reviving it and coming back into contact with it. And so some people would argue about the extent to which you can do that. They would say, well, it's very difficult to revive a religion that's been dormant for so long. But in fact, I think it is possible.
Yeah. There's a reconstruction of a lot of things, and I agree with you. I don't think that's necessarily bad or flawed, and I think this is part of the search that people are undergoing, as they leave, for example, some of the monotheistic traditions, especially Christianity. There seems to be, this sense that it's, even though they claim to be feeding the soul, it sometimes, I think, for a lot of people, doesn't meet all the needs. And as you pointed out, it doesn't meet the belly or the feet. And there's something within us that desperately wants that. But as Christianity spread and the old pagan ways were essentially demolished, what other choice do people have when they want to find something that is more authentic, that feeds the belly, and that you can, it's solid ground that the feet can stand on? We have to kind of undergo a process of reconstruction, it seems.
And it is perfectly possible to, for example, revive old customs, old pagan customs. I was in Sweden not long ago talking to a member of the Swedish pagan movement, and he told me that there's one custom, it's a rather nice custom, which is that at a wedding, a hammer, Thor, hammer of Thor, is placed in the lap of the bride, as well as you could say as a fertility symbol, as a way of blessing the marriage. So this custom had died out, but it's now been revived. So once again, that is as being done at weddings in Sweden. But it actually goes back to a story related in the Edda about the hammer of Thor, and how the hammer of Thor was stolen and recovered through the cunning of Loki. Through things like that, it is possible to achieve a reconstruction.
Yeah. And reading your book, I kind of want to get into some of the highlights of the book in your life, because it is a memoir. But again, I also want to leave a lot out to encourage people to read the book. It is a really interesting read. You moved in some interesting circles, and you've met a lot of really interesting people. And from the very beginning, as you were, I think you were in Oxford, and you began a society here. What was it? The Writers Club, the Anonymous Society of Writers. And you wrote to William S. Burroughs and invited him to be a member, and I thought, well, that's fascinating. And I connected because when you're at that time, you're like, yes, I was reading Burroughs and I was into the Surrealists, and I'm like, yes, me too. I was like that as well. So I found a connect. I just felt a little bit more connected to you reading the book, I think.
Oh, yes.
But you said that that club, that society that you began, really is how, what led you or introduced you to the esoteric world.
So I was
wondering if maybe you could speak a little bit about that, give, you know, people a taste of your spiritual journey and how all of this sort of came to you through that. And I know that you had an au pair that you say that, you know, planted the seed of your love of Germany. But I wanted to focus more on the esoteric and that, how that all unfolded for you. And
Well, I had, there was one particular member of that society who was into astrology, and he got me interested in astrology while I was a student, still a student at Oxford. And I became very intrigued by it as a sort of language, a symbolic language for categorizing people and understanding, how shall I put it, understanding the forces and influences that operate in human life. So I started experimenting with casting horoscopes and so on. And then after I left Oxford, I wrote a book about astrology. That was actually my first book, The Astrologers and Their Creed. It's a history of astrology. Someone else I got to know at Oxford told me about Aleister Crowley. And I got very intrigued by Crowley as well. I read John Simon's biography of him, The Great Beast. And I also heard about Gerald York, who was Crowley's chief disciple for a number of years. And, well, to cut a long story short, I got to know Gerald York. I met him at an esoteric conference. And at one point I was planning to make a film about Crowley, and got together with a film producer, John Phillips. And we went to visit York at his stately home in Gloucestershire. He was a very fascinating man. He was a country squire and a brilliant scholar. And he had been a very close disciple of Crowley for a number of years. And so he could talk endlessly in a very fascinating way about Crowley. So he was another important influence on me. Another person who had an influence on me was Ian Hamilton Finlay, who was a Scottish poet and an artist, who had created a wonderful garden together with his wife in the Pentland Hills near Edinburgh. And it was a kind of garden of the gods, actually. And it was the whole garden complex was dedicated to Apollo. And there was an a form of farm property, and one of the outbuildings he'd converted into an Apollo temple. And so anyway, I became friendly with him. I was a close friend of his for about 30 years. And he was an interesting character because he started off as very much an avant-garde figure in the avant-garde scene in Edinburgh. He was almost a kind of hippie in a way, but then he became very much a traditionalist, and his whole art was focused on tradition, in particular the classical, the European classical tradition, and he considered himself to be a champion of this tradition, and in fact he got involved in a number of quarrels with various people as a result of this. Anyway, what one thing that I learned from him is that tradition is not like a chain that weighs you down, but rather it's an accumulation of lessons from the past that help you in the present, help you to live a good life in the present. So that was, he had an important influence on me as well. And it was he who really turned me on to gardening and the creation of gardens. And the garden that I'm now creating here is, it has elements that are influenced by him. Yeah, so all these people had an important influence on my life.
Yeah, and you worked in circles of, like with Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who's a name I'm familiar with. I've read some of his books. Jocelyn Goodwin as well. Tobias Churton, I've had him on the podcast a couple of times.
Oh, yes.
I have an episode coming up with him pretty soon. And when you were working with him, that was a documentary on the Rosicrucians, because you developed an interest, and you've written a book on the Rosicrucians as well.
Yes.
But this was being made for Joost Rittman.
Yeah.
Did you meet Joost?
Yes. I knew him as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because he's the one who founded the Rittman Library in Amsterdam.
Yes.
Which is,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a documentary on the Rittman Library
that
I will I watch every now and then, and I would love to go visit there. You were also associated at the time. There were some, and I didn't write the names down, but there were some school programs that offered education in sort of these esoteric traditions. But most of those have gone away, haven't they?
Well, yes and no. There was a program at Exeter University, which was founded through the initiative of Nicholas Goodrich Clark. He was a remarkable guy. He was a person of enormous energy and charisma and drive. And he went to the university and persuaded them to start up this program. And was called the Exeter Center for Western Esotericism. And it was a very good program. It was a distance program, basically, where there was contact with the students through email and telephone. And two or three times a year, there would be a seminar at Exeter to which these students would come. And they came from far and wide. There were people who came from Alaska, from Sweden, from Finland, from Canada, all over the place, because for someone who wanted to study, esotericism at that level, it was essentially an MA course, and it was. Virtually the only thing available. It was the only distance program available. So it was tremendously valuable. It was offering something very, very valuable to these students. So I was part of that program. Tobias Churton was part of it as well. I was part of it for about 5 years. And then Nicholas Goodrich Clark very unexpectedly died. And it kept going for about a year after that, through the efforts of his wife Claire. But then it folded up. But since then, the university has started up another program in esotericism, which I haven't had any contact with. I think they're doing something slightly similar. But as I say, I'm not well informed about it. But apart from that, there's the program in Amsterdam, led by Wouter Hannegraaff, which is not, it's not a distance learning program. It's on the spot in Amsterdam. And there's a graduate program at the Sorbonne, which is, I think, must be the oldest program in this field. And it goes right back, I guess, to maybe the 1940s or so. But there are other things going on. That there are increasingly departments that are offering courses in esotericism as part of another faculty, like religious studies or history or whatever. And some of the people who went through the Amsterdam program have gone on to teach in these programs. So there's quite a lot going on.
Yeah. Do you think that, how do I want to phrase this question? Personally, I've seen, and I don't know if this is American or European or, you know, Western. One of the reasons that I decided to go to the doctoral program that I went to, it was at the California Institute of Integral Studies, because they took seriously esoteric thought. And I appreciate seeing esotericism and, you know, the different aspect, you know, the Hermetic tradition and whatnot, as valid and crucial lines in the formulation of the Western world. Yeah. But yet traditional academia, for some reason, has divorced themselves from it. I think in large part, this is probably part of the Enlightenment agenda to make a separation between like philosophy and what's religion. And I'm hoping that there is a move to start bringing these things back into traditional academia, not just places like CIIS, but to be able to look at this line of thought, because it seems like if we ignore it or suppress it, we're ignoring a very vital part of the human story.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And it gives you a window or a series of windows into a whole range of areas that no other discipline gives you. So it gives you a window onto history, onto religion, onto the arts, onto many, many, many things. Yeah.
Yeah, I see like little vestiges of it popping up here and there, but for the most part, it's still not, I'll just say that it's very difficult to find a job teaching that in the United States.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But we do have some places that, while not schools, we can call them institutes maybe.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous one here. And the program that I graduated from actually had its birth at the Esalen Institute.
Oh, yes.
I know you've been to Esalen. And that was, as I was reading the book, and you talked about your visit to Esalen, you noted that you were picked up at the airport, I believe, by a Walter Tanner. And I'm like, I know Tanner. So it was like, that was his small world. It's like, oh, we know someone in common. probably more. I know Tobias Turton now too. So, but you know, we have Esalen in Scotland. There had been Findhorn. My understanding is that Findhorn has closed down, and I'm curious. Yeah, that's my understanding, is that they closed down about a year or two ago. But it seems like we need more places like this. That, you know, not everyone wants to go to college for this, but I think people have this quest to be, you know, their souls want to be nourished with these sorts of things. And it seems like these institutes and centers could be a good place.
Yeah. Yes. Well, another aspect is the way in which pagan ideas are now taking hold in philosophy and psychology. When you think of, for example, the work of James Hillman, now he's extremely interesting because he was in effect a kind of pagan. And there's one book of his that's very interesting called Re-envisioning Psychology, where he talks about how paganism is a much better way, or a much better lens through which to see the human mind than monotheism is, because the human mind is actually many people under one roof. And so the pagan, the polytheistic perspective is a much better way of approaching the human mind. And his view of the gods is very interesting. There's one lecture of his, it's actually posted on the internet, where he quotes, in fact, something that Joseph Campbell wrote, which was that the gods are not dead. They are alive and well, and standing on the corner of Broadway and 42nd Street, waiting for the lights to change. So, well, I've passed that corner many times when I was living in New York, but I wasn't looking out for gods at the time. But if I had been, I might have seen a few. But his view of the gods is very interesting. He regards them as actual entities, and he says, for example, if you're having love problems, then you should get in touch with the goddess Aphrodite or Venus and ask for her advice. So this is extremely pagan. And there are a number of philosophers also who have wrote interestingly about paganism, like the French philosopher Alain de Benoist, who's written a book called On Being a Pagan. So that's another interesting development that's going on.
Yeah, one of the things that I find, and this is outside of the book, although I'm pretty sure I've strayed outside the book a few times already, but I've been really influenced by Peter Kingsley and some of his writings, and how he is demonstrating that, like the pre-Socratic philosophers, that they were, I mean, they were definitely pagan. They're definitely kind of polytheistic, but there was a kind of ecstatic aspect to it of the incubation in caves, and that their philosophy was literally inspired at that time by these sort of shamanic visions, if you will.
Absolutely.
And Socrates taught us to listen to our daemons.
Yes. Well, and it's possible that something like the theorem of Pythagoras came to Pythagoras in a shamanic vision.
Yeah, that would make philosophy departmental meetings very different, I think, than what they are now.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, something that I think is important, going back to the paths that you describe, you know, and the belly, that physical, visceral aspect to things. You wrote a little bit about dance and sort of cultural dances, and I'll just share this very briefly. And this happened probably a good 20 years ago or so. I was walking through a park in Denver and just feeling kind of frustrated about current events and wars that the United States was instigating, and just kind of down on people in general. And I was walking, and it was evening, it was nighttime, and I passed the center where there was a group of people, and I don't know what they were wearing, like traditional costumes, or I shouldn't even say costumes, but I don't know what culture they represented. It was something, I think, from like the Scandinavia or somewhere, and they were doing a dance. And all of a sudden I thought, You know, as bad as humanity can seem sometimes, we still come together and dance.
Well, I used to run a dance group here, actually in Bremen, where we used to live. And we started off doing English Morris dance. There's a picture in the book of our Morris dance group. And then we went on to doing German folk dances and some Latvian and Scottish folk dances. And these folk dances, they link us with authentic traditional cultures. Because if you look at the patterns of the dance, they incorporate cosmic patterns. So in a way, they're a kind of ritual. But they require practice and patience to learn the movements. But they offer something which modern pop dance just doesn't offer. So this is another sort of element in that local culture that I was talking about.
Yeah, well, and I think it's really important because, as you observed before, we don't have a lot of the texts from the traditions that have, were largely eradicated. But what we have are the memories that show up, like in the dance. You have these ongoing traditions, and it seems like that's, it's a kind of a text in itself.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, everyone should dance. It's a good
Oh,
thing.
absolutely.
Dance and get to know where you live. And one of the last things I wanted to ask you about is because, I'm very happy that you're saying that there is a growing sort of pagan movement. And, like I said, here in the States, it's more of the spiritual but not religious, but I definitely see some pagan aspects to that. But one of the things that you noted, especially when you were talking about London, was the god Pan.
Oh, yes.
And that you kind of said that Pan, I'm trying to find the quote here again. Excuse my notes. I don't know if I can find it. But anyway, yeah, there we go. A god that appears to have exerted a particular fascination in Britain is Pan, the goat-legged, flute-playing god of nature, of shepherds, and of wild abandon. And of course, Pan is recognized kind of as the only god that died. The great Pan is dead. And when we look at modern London, it's very easy to think of Pan being dead. And I'm curious though, because I don't think that Pan's dead. I think
Oh, no.
Pan's just been kind of sleeping maybe off to the side. And I'm curious if you think that there will be a revival of Pan. Is there hope for London? Is there hope for the Western world for these gods to reappear? I think I already know your answer, but
Well, I agree with what Jung said in Carl Gustav Jung in an essay he wrote, which was that the gods never die. A god is like a river, and if people stop worshipping the god, then the river ceases to flow and the riverbed dries up. But as soon as they start worshipping him again, and the river starts to flow again, it flows into the bed, and the river is there again. And I think that's certainly true of Pan. The idea that he was dead was an idea that was promoted at the time of the coming of Christianity. A voice was supposed to have been heard calling out over the Aegean that the great god Pan is dead. And there's a poem at the beginning of Dian Fortune's book, The Goatfoot God, which is it's one of my favorite novels. She has a poem at the beginning that starts off came the voice of destiny calling o'er the Ionian Sea, the great god Pan is dead, humbled is the horned head, and so on. But then it ends up with, well, the god is coming back. Pan is coming back. We must be ready to welcome him when he comes back. And Pan is sort of like, he's what I would call an egregore, a thought form created by many people thinking the same thoughts and focusing on the same ideas and symbols. And so he's a powerful egregore, and he crops up everywhere in that painting by Edward Burne-Jones that I included in the book, and in a novel by Lord Dunsany, the Anglo-Irish writer Lord Dunsany, called The Blessing of Pan, and in the Kenneth Graham's book, The Wind in the Willows, the famous children's book, The Wind in the Willows, and any number of images of Pan that keep cropping up in the art of Aubrey Beardsley, he crops up, and also in the Wicca movement, founded by Gerald Gardner, there are two deities, the goddess of the moon, and the horned god of the sun. Well, the horned god of the sun is really Pan, so. In Wicca, Gerald Gardner has also invoked Pan. And Diane Fortune, one of the sort of central message of that book, The Great God, the Goatfoot God, is that there's a Pan energy that we need, this kind of strong, thrusting, masculine energy in nature and in the world. And she calls it vitamin P. you would say vitamin P. Anyway, yes. she calls it vitamin P. And this novel is about, the central character in it is a young man who's a bit sort of mixed up and adrift and doesn't know where his life is going. And the point being that he is lacking in vitamin P. So the story of the Goatfoot God is how he really comes to integrate this Pan energy.
Well, and it seems like it's something that would be very necessary now. There's this idea of there needs to be a little bit of a different kind of masculine energy, because you have the kind of the patriarchal monotheistic traditions where that masculine energy is one of conquering and often of violence and war and whatnot. But if you redirect that same sort of masculine energy to creation and nature, it seems like it could help solve a lot of the world's problems.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in Wicca, The two, the god and the goddess, complement each other. But actually, the goddess is the more important figure of the two in Wicca. The god is her consort, but they complement each other.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like that's, like I said, that is a good medicine for the world, it seems.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So I know that we are at the end of our hour. So let me ask you the final questions that I always ask. One is, what do you have coming up next? I know you end the book with your 80th birthday, but I think you still have a lot to do. So what do you have coming up?
Well, at the moment I'm working on a book on Prague. Because Prague is another place that has been very important to me over the years. Ooh. Prague is, you could say that, the magical capital of Europe. And it's absolutely steeped in magic and the occult, going back many centuries, right back to the time when the English Magus John Dee visited Prague, and all kinds of alchemists and occultists were active in Prague. And it's still, that tradition is still very, very active in Prague. So my book is, it's a sort of journey through the esoteric history of Prague, and sort of focusing on certain highlights related to that history.
That sounds fascinating, and I want to read that book. Prague is a place that I've been wanting to go to for a very long time. And should I find my, if I'm able to make the leap across the pond, as I'm hoping, I'm going to do a lot more traveling. I was jealous of all the traveling that you described in your book, but Prague is definitely on my list. It's been on my list. Kafka is one of my favorite authors. So, just for that. And then when I started learning more of the history, its connections to alchemy and the esoterics, I'm like, yes, I must go to Prague. So do you have a website that people can go to find out more about you and your work, or social media or anything like that?
Yes, well, I have a website, which is www.ozgard, that's spelled O-Z-G-A-R-D, .net, N-E-T.
Okay. All right. All right, wonderful. I will put a link for that in the show notes and video description, as well as links to your new book. And like I said, it was a very enjoyable read, and I felt like I got to know you a little bit better than just, you know, the conversations that, you know, the previous conversations we had, and I really appreciated it. And so I thank you for your time today, and hopefully when the Prague book comes out, we can speak again.
That would be great.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Christopher.
You're welcome.
And that's a wrap on episode 209 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now I have over 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 13 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I do love it, but it's a lot of labor. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little of my way. With more subscribers and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also purchase a Super Thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.